This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, August 9th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is Bare Bones Broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org and youtube.com/veraicona100. She is the author of numerous books, including one that she's currently working on that will be available soon. Her most current book is Hitler and Himmler Uncensored. And we're going to talk about something very interesting today, as usual. So welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
Good.
Good. Just been really busy this week.
Oh, me too.
Working on the car and all that fun stuff. Okay, but I managed to squeeze in some reading of The Occult Roots of Nazism. I hate that term, but he uses it. And it's by Nicholas Goodrick Clark. And this is actually, I think, the only one of these books that's really mainstream. And this was actually put out by New York University Press.
Oh.
And I've only gotten like a third the way through it. I read it years ago and I'm going back through it, but we'll just touch on some of the fallacies of what he argues and the omissions. The omissions are really important. And then we're going to talk about Farrell's Brotherhood of the Bell. And I'm almost done with this, a little over halfway. So, but I've gotten to the part about the bell. So real quick before it like jumps out of my head, because it's very complicated what he argues as far as the physics. And I am a total dodo head when it comes to math, science, and physics. I didn't take any of that stuff. I took chemistry and that was it.
Okay.
And barely got through it. But basically what he's saying about this supposed bell, which in fact no one has ever verified actually existed. Okay, we do not know that this even existed. So there's really no documentation for it. There are hints about it, possibly. But because the actual object disappeared, and the Comler group that was supposed to kind of be the spearhead behind this thing, you know, he disappeared, Hans Comler. No one knows if it even existed or if this research was going on. Farrell builds like kind of this esoteric circumstantial case around it and just really goes into strange corners of the world with his the Nazis killed JFK kind of a thing, and they're really running NASA, etc. So if one has read Jim Mars's Rise of the Fourth Reich, you really have the gist of Farrell's thesis there. So you don't even really need to read the bell unless you want a technical, you know, odyssey. But what he says is the bell was basically about two things: field propulsion, and then also an examination into the basic structure of matter, what it really is, what it exists in, kind of its relationship, you know, of one item to its environment, if you will, and how to transform it. So I guess if this bell really existed, the Germans were interested in plasma technology to use it in a destructive capability. Oh my gosh, they could blow up planets with this. That's basically what he argues, which I find a little bit over the top. The Germans certainly wouldn't have been using WMD in this sense. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. But that's basically what he's saying the bell was. They were looking into kind of the plasma technology, how to concentrate gamma radiation, if you will, like a gamma ray laser, that kind of stuff, to see what kind of destruction they could wreak.
I just don't believe that either.
Yeah. I know that there is allegations that the Nazis were researching atomic weaponry. And I think that the circumstantial case and what we have in that respect is very compelling. I do think that Hitler's team was on the verge or had created an atomic bomb, or, you know, was very close. I think their limit was the triggering of the device and the delivery. I think that's where the Germans fell short and where the Anglo-Saxons had a better delivery system. They had their, was it B-12? Or is it B-2?
I'm not sure.
The bomber that dropped the atomic bombs.
Okay.
I think it's B-12. The Germans didn't really have, I suppose they could have used one of the Junkers models, but I don't think they had an aircraft that was actually capable of hauling an atomic bomb. Not that I know of, anyway. If someone knows otherwise, they can, you know, shoot you an email or whatever. But I don't think so. I think that's where the development of the Silverbird comes in, which would have been capable. That would have been a long-range bomber, very futuristic prototype. So I guess that's about that. There were other weapons they were developing. If one was to read Henry Stevens's book on the NS secret weapons, they had like mercury weapons and some kind of fuel air bomb type stuff they were testing. So yes, pretty much every advanced country at that time was thinking along the same lines and almost at the same level. This isn't some mystery. It's not the Germans being these, you know, kind of voodoo creatures, you know, this esoteric basis of their incredible technological knowledge. I mean, we may be going a little overboard in giving the Germans a little too much credit. That's what I think Farrell's doing here. He's giving them almost like a godlike status technologically. Now, they were very advanced and they were further ahead than I think any of the other countries, but they weren't, I don't know if I buy this plasma technology thing and that they were actually developing scalar weapons. I think that's how you say it.
Right. I think that he is trying to build them up to intimidate us into thinking, into believing some of the stuff that is now being put out about them. Now, the Enola Gay was a Boeing B-29.
Okay, B-29. That's it. I can't believe I couldn't even remember that. Yeah. So as far as I know, Germans didn't have trigger or delivery. Now, allegedly, and Stevens goes over this, there are other authors. Allegedly, I think it was U-234 or 5, the U-boat, had the uranium on it. It may have even had, according to some people, little boy. It was actually on board this submarine, and it was intercepted and grabbed by the United States. And that's why we ended up dropping uranium bombs. I think both of our atomic bombs were uranium. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. I know I'm almost certain little boy was. Now, we actually were developing plutonium atomic bombs, not uranium. And we did not have enough enriched uranium at that time. So there are some strange timing issues there where all of a sudden you get this, the goods on this submarine that's German, and you suddenly have these atomic bombs that you're dropping on Japan.
Yeah.
Pretty compelling case there. But again, scalar weapons, the Germans kind of understanding. Their radar technology certainly hints at that, that the Germans were thinking more Tesla-like.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking in different terms. And really what I think the core of this debate is the Germans were more or less dissatisfied with relativity type physics, Einsteinian, Anglo-Jewish physics.
Right.
And they were going in another direction with their studies. And I think that's why they were further ahead.
Right.
But as far as actually having scalar weapons and stuff, and it was this esoteric thing, and they were going to have a German Teutonic Empire, come on. I mean, he's just pulling that out of a magic hat.
I think so, too.
Doesn't exist. So, for example, one thing Farrell says is that, well, let me just quote him. And that organization was, by definition, a military secret society. He's talking about the Teutonic Order or whatever, whose core ideology, was the establishment of a world empire.
Oh, please.
With German, with Prussian specifically, hegemony at its heart and height. So I questioned him and I wrote, how come the Anglo-Saxons, we're talking about Britain, her satellites in America, the Anglo-Saxons, and the Jutsis are in charge then?
Exactly.
If the Germans have created this world empire, where is it? Where is it? And what is it doing? If it's working behind the scenes and doing all this stuff like Farrell suggests, can anyone point to even one example where this Teutonic order has succeeded in some secret machination? As far as Germany in Europe today, in its position of power over other European states, that comes strictly from their performance and their merit. I mean, let's look at Greece and the way it was spending, the way it manages its affairs. It's a political zoo there. Germany doesn't have that kind of chaos, that kind of insane spending. America's kind of one of those insane spenders too. The problem is a lot of European countries have gotten into this habit of consumerism, and America has too. And Germany and some other countries, I think China's another one, are savers.
Mm-hmm.
They don't mass consume and endlessly consume. So, you know, it's not because of some secret order. It's simply because they know how to manage themselves. They know how to do things efficiently. They're not, you know, spending like a 16-year-old with a credit card that goes up to $100,000.
Right.
You know, just basic common sense. So, you know, I don't think anyone has any credibility when they start going, well, look at Germany now. I mean, you know, and the fact that they're sending weapons and doing some things for Israel, we know why that is.
Right, because they're an occupied government.
Yes, they are guilty forever and ever. And my goodness, they've got to keep the reparations coming.
Right.
Unfortunately, the Germans are the kind of people that feel that they need to compensate. We don't really have that. The Anglo nations don't really have that. They are kind of the more get over it. You know, you're my enemy. Get over it. You know, bygones be bygones.
Right. So what if we've destroyed your country? Just get on with it.
Right. And I think the Russians and certainly the Japanese have more of that attitude. Unfortunately, the Germans don't have that attitude. And so they're killing themselves. To make Israel some kind of world power, which it just isn't and can't be for a number of reasons. You know, that's just one of those things where they feel guilt-tripped into continuing to be codependent to Israel, the world addict.
Right. And of course, our leadership buys into that. And they've installed just the right leaders who will accommodate that
exactly.
Mentality.
Exactly. You know, I even question him because he goes on to say, like, for example, the Order of the Teutonic Knights must be considered the real heir to the global imperial ambitions of the medieval German emperors.
That is ridiculous.
So the German Empire itself. So again, why is Germany so weak then? I mean, let's look at this BRD government. It's a joke.
Right.
You know, it's a joke. Any German will tell you that. And then, of course, he goes on to say that the Hohenzollerns were the grand masters of the order. The Hohenzollerns were completely destroyed, stripped of power, you know, really nominal power only. Just the name Hohenzollern may have had a little bit of an effect on, you know, individuals that thought big of them. But they were slaughtered politically by Jutsis and the various isms, communism, socialism, republicanism. I mean, even Hitler wasn't into restoring the monarchy.
No.
That's a past age. We're moving into a different age. So, you know, I'm not seeing how the Hohenzollerns have continued to reign or somehow behind, you know, closed doors, they're supposed to be in power to this day. Wow, how amazing. They're heirs.
It is.
And then, of course, he goes on to say, my bird is chirping. Be quiet. Okay. A few months after the beginning of the present war, a short notice appeared in German papers announcing that Hitler himself had been initiated into the Teutonic Order.
Oh, that is so ridiculous.
No. No, you're not going to give me that as your proof that Hitler was initiated, because some paper, no name, no date, no nothing, not only that, an article in a paper, anyone can put that in there.
Sure.
And that's his evidence. Hitler was never initiated into any order. He was never, ever a member of any secret society. And everyone goes, oh, well, you know, Thule Gesellschaft, the Thule Society. No, he was never a member. Never.
I think even Wikipedia says that.
Yeah. The so-called Foil Society, no one even knows if that existed. There's no actual hard documentation for the Foil Society. So we're not going with that either. Now, Hitler accepted the patronage and the support of members of the Thule Society. And I would pose this issue to those who scream and wail about this kind of stuff. If you yourself were in Hitler's position and you were pretty much the only hope for a country, you were a genuine middle, lower class, just working class person, had kind of gotten your way up there, were being pushed by, you know, certain groups, got some support, were actually getting somewhere with your party. Would you not accept the support of Masons if you had one up on them? Let's say you were using them. They may think they're using you, but what if you're using them for your agenda and so that you can get into power? And then once you're in power, you ban Masonry, you round them up, put them in concentration camps if they refuse to stop doing their fifth column activity in your country once you are in power. Does that make you a Mason? Does it make you supportive of Masonry because you had accepted the support of individual Masons when you were first starting up your party? See, this is the problem that people automatically go up, guilt by association. It doesn't matter if certain people who initially supported Hitler or who even continued to support him were into the occult or Aryan philosophy or whatever they want to call it, whatever these people were into. It doesn't matter. What did Hitler believe? What did he sanction officially? What was the party's line? What was he feeding to the public? Catholicism, Protestantism. Hitler always supported the unification of the two factions of Christianity into a centralized Reich Church. Hitler never once spoke against the person of Jesus Christ. Now, there are people today who say that Jesus Christ never even existed. There's people that say, you know, he's boiling in hot excrement or whatever in hell.
Yeah, and we know who's saying that.
Hey, that's our free speech. But my goodness, Hitler, you know, he never said anything against Jesus Christ, ever, not once. And as a matter of fact, he was supportive of Christ's idea, accepted that he had existed historically. And this is not only in the table talk, it's in the Wagner memoirs. One can get information about what he thought from Winifred Wagner, from Albert Speer. He doesn't say too much on it, but he says a little bit. And also from Leni Riefenstahl. One need only go through, you know, any number of memoirs, even the Mein Kampf.
Right.
And you never find Hitler saying that Christ never existed or I'm a Satanist or even speaking against the faith of Christianity. The only problem Hitler had with Christianity was political Christianity, particularly political Catholicism, because it was a Roman religion, Italian, if you will, and he saw its activities as kind of fifth column because it was always against the prevailing German order. Why do you Catholics always have to be against the prevailing order in this country? What is your problem? That's his perspective. And the Catholics were overwhelmingly opposed to the NSDAP. They caused a lot of trouble. We know for a fact, for example, that the two assassins who murdered in cold blood Reinhard Heydrich were protected by these Catholic priests. They were hidden in a church. This church had literally, I think it was about 100 resistance people hiding there. You know, that's the kind of thing that the Catholics were doing in Germany under Hitler, and he was supposed to turn a blind eye to that. That's all he opposed. It just its political agenda and its seemingly odd sympathy for fifth column activity, anarchists, and communists, oddly.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because when you consider some of the Catholic activists here in this country that were opposing communism and opposing FDR, you think, well, how come, what's going on here? How come the Catholics in Germany weren't more supportive?
Exactly. It really begs the question. And unfortunately, there's this Schulungsbrief article. It's not an article, it's a magazine, but it's an issue of that was put out by the NSDAP. And I couldn't get it. It was already sold. I was really bummed, because almost the whole issue is written, various essays, writings by Reinhard Heydrich against particularly Freemasonry, but also like the Rotary. They called it the Rotary back then. It's just Rotary Club today. So Masonry, Rotary Club, Shriners,
Oddfellows, all those combinations.
Yeah, political Catholicism. He gave a special little section to the Catholic Church and why it was a problem for Germany and how that problem could be eliminated without destroying the faith. And see, that's really important. There are very few historians who have been able to understand that the NS opposition to Christianity was not against the faith per se. It was against the activities of the political side of the faith, the churches, churchianity. They were against churchianity. They were also against the Judaization of Christianity. And the Reich, there was a Reich research department that went through, I think Alfred Rosenberg was part of this. He was somehow affiliated with this. But they went through the Bible and removed everything St. Paul, a.k.a. Rabbi Salas, said for Jesus. Took all that out. Because why do we need to hear Rabbi Salas? Get him out of there. They did. The NSDAP did not believe that St. Paul ever genuinely converted. The way Hitler puts it is, he says, St. Paul saw the potential of Christianity as a revolutionary subversive movement against the Roman authorities. That's why he wanted to get control over it and use it for the Jews. This was going to be another means, another vehicle to the new future Jewish power in the Roman Empire. So when people say that Christianity is just a branch of Judaism and it's just a Jewish religion, it was used by Jews, but there is in fact no proof that it's a Jewish religion or that Christ himself was Jewish. This is a huge debate that's, you know, still...
Oh, right. Yeah, it's ongoing. I mean, he was not from Well, I've read all the arguments about it, and
Right. And Hitler said it's inconceivable that if Christ did in fact say what he said in the Bible,
yeah,
he was Jewish. Jews just don't think like this.
No, they do not.
So Hitler himself in the table talk says, I don't buy it. Christ was an Aryan, and he must be seen as the first socialist revolutionary who inspired a movement that was heightened to religiosity. So, you know, you're only going to see respect for the person of Christ coming from Hitler. Hitler himself, he stayed nominally Catholic, but he was actually just a God-believing person. Spiritual, God-believing, very much into nature and, you know, kind of the whole preservation of the entire system of Earth. You know, he wasn't, he didn't support science's exploitation and destruction of Earth kind of a thing either. And there are many quotes where Hitler is kind of saying, I can't think of it verbatim, but he goes, any scientist such as those of the Bolsheviks who think that they can triumph over creation are fools, and all they will do, all they'll achieve is the destruction of man. So, you know, there's all kinds of little quotes like that where Hitler is anti-science. He was a little bit ambivalent about science. So that's another thing. Hitler was not the inspiration behind the various super weapons, et cetera, that Joseph Farrell and whatnot writes about. It was just German technology. They'd always been kind of techies. They're kind of a gadget people.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just Germanness. This is Germanity, if you will. Hitler wasn't, you know, some prime mover behind the V weapons or anything like that. I'm not seeing the esoteric basis of the super weapons either. This just, you know, he's got a lot of, all throughout the book, I can tell you the first, I'm on page 250 right now, and everything is if we can build the circumstantial case, we can surmise, it's alleged, apparently unknown, we can speculate. I mean, almost every single page in this book, he can't name the person. It's eyewitness hearsay evidence. It's some allied report. If this happened, I shall surmise. He has no fact. There's nothing hard in this book. He paints a lot of sketchy scenarios. So, you know, for example, when Wernher von Braun made a statement to Time magazine, well, what did that really mean? Braun must have been trying to tell us something.
It's more of those code words and winks and all that. You know how the Germans are.
Yeah, he allegedly gives a statement to Time that Farrell's reading like planet-busting potential into. And then because Wernher von Braun resigned or, you know, whatever from NASA shortly after that, well, it must have been because he said that. Do you have a causal link to, can you prove that? No, he can't. He really can't prove much of anything except the documents he gives, like on radar technology and stuff being developed by the German Navy, etc. And the fact that the Germans were thinking in more quantum physics terms than relativity physics ideas. So yes, in that respect, they were ahead, but I mean, he's even got an account. This is just so ludicrous, where the Germans allegedly put hapless concentration camp inmates from Großrosen around the bell and then turned it on and destroyed these people, literally melted them down to like some kind of gray goo. And then from there, they crystallized. So they literally broke down the very cellular structure of these innocent concentration camp inmates, not one of which we can name. And who saw this happening and lived to tell about it?
Right.
We didn't find any Kammler documents, so who actually said this happened? Come on! And then he's got another cute one where I think at least 70 SS scientists, we're talking about the most highly classified individuals that exist, were mass murdered by their own and in an unmarked mass grave that we still don't know where it is.
You know, I don't own any of Farrell's books except as PDF files that I got for nothing. That's what I think of his work.
Yeah. I mean, as a science person, he's interesting. Okay, when he's talking about scalar weapons, atomic stuff, cool, great, very good. But let's not talk about the JFK assassination, Mr. Farrell, and how Hitler was really the inspiration behind it, and how Bormann fled to Argentina or whatever, when you don't have any proof.
Right.
It's no proof whatsoever. In fact, there's proof suggesting otherwise, that Bormann actually died. They found his skull and his jaw almost completely intact. And, you know, a scientist cannot ever say, I know 100% this is Martin Bormann. I am that sure. You can't do that because there's always, always, always going to be the factor of uncertainty, even when you have DNA testing, because we don't know if the bones mingled with other bones, kind of a thing, what other stuff that skull came into contact with, whether someone's blood was on it at any point, which can, you know, DNA data when they test it after the fact. But the guy was like 99% certain, which is certain for science, that it was Bormann's skull. He died. He did not go to Argentina and have some Bormann network that's bent on conquering the world for the NSDAP. The NSDAP does not exist anymore. It just, I don't know what it's going to take to get people like Mars and Farrell off this. Raise the horse.
Probably if they don't get their paycheck from the government.
Yeah, I will say one thing. It does not pay to criticize Israel and the Jutsis.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, we have to expect to be impoverished and destroyed in some respect, or certainly at least harassed. Whereas if you write something that's anti-NS, anti-German, and way out there on left field, you're a New York Times bestseller.
Exactly.
So...
even if you've only sold 10 books.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so getting to this Goodrich Clark. This is so revealing. This is in the very introduction, but it is so revealing. I'm just going to read it, and we're going to ask ourselves, what is missing here? I mean, it's so obvious. He says, idealistic visions of political order have given way to ideologies of cultural identity in which religion plays a major part. The rapid growth and impact of Islamic militancy, Hindu nationalism, and Christian fundamentalism in the 1990s. And then he goes on to kind of talk about how these are very destructive and horrible, and oh, we need to watch out for this stuff. This is like rise of Nazism again. He's missing the most important one that runs the world right now.
It would seem apparent that he's missing a certain ethnic group.
I mean, is that not based on religion and extremism and everything he condemns?
Yes.
Racism, extremism based on religion, kind of the idea of dominance of other groups. Israel? Zionism, no mention of that whatsoever. He goes on to talk about neo-Nazis. So, you know, great. You know, we have, to me, neo-Nazis are so far down on the threat scale as to be negligible. There is no neo-Nazi threat. There might be an individual here or there that's, you know, supposedly taken in by this ideology, whatever neo-Nazism is. I don't even really know what it is. It's just racism that identifies with the Third Reich in its symbols. It doesn't identify with the real Reich and what it really meant. It just takes the symbols and associates it with a hate agenda. You know, Hitler remarked many times that any group that hates is suffering from, I'm trying to think of the word. Basically, they feel inadequate.
Right, incompleteness of some sort.
Yes, a weakness thing. And he says, we do not hate anybody. We don't hate Britain. We don't hate other races. There are many references where he says we don't hate because we don't have an inferiority complex.
Ah.
Hitler says that hate stems from that. And there's one reference in particular where he says, I do not have an inferiority complex when it comes to Britain. And that was absolutely genuine. Hitler could have taken down Britain militarily if they hadn't gotten 57 nations and practically the entire world against him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one-on-one match, the Wehrmacht would have annihilated.
Oh, absolutely.
Annihilated. With no question at all. So, you know, that's really the problem with that. And this guy, of course, is trying to make a big case for neo-Nazism and how it's this huge threat.
I think it's just kind of a CIA operation or a media operation. When I think of neo-Nazis, I think of skinheads with tattoos and earrings. And I think they just bring these people out just to say, now see, this is what the Nazis are. It's just putting a negative connotation on the NSDAP when it's totally irrelevant.
Exactly. It's totally irrelevant. And I agree, it's mostly media. You just don't see a lot of these people around. I've come across in my lifetime maybe a handful of these real hardcore skinheads. They're not out there. They act like they're everywhere. And this is because of the SPLC. They need to justify the enormous amount of money that they use every year in their high-tech operation and their weapon scanning devices when you walk into their building, etc. So they got to sell you some spook show.
Right.
Now we're on the neo-Nazi threat in America. That's why you're paying us billions of dollars a year. Not that much, but, you know, it's silly. It really is silly. So, real quick, this is what he has written about kind of England versus the Germans. And I wrote what the Britzies thought about the NSDAP. And this is important. At that time, it had become the fashion in England, certainly, to regard the Nazis as hardly more than a bunch of gangsters who had by some economic or propagandist trick won the following of the liberal-minded bulk of the German people. Now, he tries to get a deeper explanation. No. This was Aryanism. This was esoteric. This was occult. That's how the Nazis won. I'm going, what? Okay, both of you are wrong. So we're supposed to see the Germans, the NSDAP, as a bunch of gangsters who somehow, through propaganda and, you know, the collapse of the German economy, got into power. What England is really revealing when they say this kind of stuff, the English and especially English historians, and they still say this kind of stuff today. I mean, it's article after article in the Daily Mail and all this stuff. What they're really saying and what they're really revealing is that you lower class, working class, and middle class people are garbage. You know, we high society, high English, because they have this deeply, deeply embedded classism there. You'll never get away with that again. We see you as gangsters, as lowlifes. The only way you lowlifes can get into power is through some manipulative and horror-ridden process. And it leads to genocide. I mean, let's look at the NSDAP. It led to genocide. When the working class rules, it equals genocide and horror and fascism. Because when you look at the fascist movements all across the world at that time and the National Socialist movements, they were almost exclusively working lower and middle class. So what these English historians and what this attitude really reveals at its deepest level is a condemnation of the working and middle class. They are associating those, the people under the high class, with fascism. They are not to rule. This will never happen again. And that's why they continue to put the blackest labels, occult, genocide, ethnic cleansing, terror, on fascist, middle class, lower class, working class movements. The only movement that was like that was communism, and it really wasn't a middle class movement. That was an exploitation and usurpation, mostly by a Jewish-led cabal of an initially working class movement.
Right.
So, you know, this attitude that the NSDAP, I mean, I'm going through some of these old Ballantine books. If you ever want to read just a scathing, horribly biased, you know, any kind of history of the NSDAP, I'm reading one of their books on Heydrich. I mean, they're describing him as an evil monster, his glinting cold eyes of steel. He's just an average guy. You know, he didn't do what people think. And by the way, I'm going to start looking into that Lidice massacre in Czechoslovakia, because I don't think that happened.
Really?
Another hoax. And there's many people involved in this that were sellouts as far as the Gleiwitz hoax. So I'm starting to look at these people in familiar. Okay, we see Lahausen is connected with Lidice. How revealing. He was also connected with the alleged Abwehr jumping the gun before Hitler actually declared war on Poland at Mosty. He's connected to that, and he's connected to Gleiwitz. Gave testimony about it as a false flag. These characters are all there. And so what I'm seeing is a connection between all these supposed genocidal massacres and false flag type stuff, and, you know, acts of baseless aggression by the Germans, are all the same IMT people that sold out to the Allies and implicated their fellow Germans who couldn't speak for themselves. So I thought that was really interesting. But, you know, there is some kind of strange English animosity towards Germany, especially, and notably against the NSDAP, I think, in my view, and I explore this in the Union Jackal a little bit, and we're going to get into it more in Albion and Zion United, that it's, to me, the animosity is really directed at the hardworkingness and the middle class prevalence and power that Germany gives, that it provides to its people, that it's this high society state.
Right. And there was no classes. Everybody was felt like they were treated fairly by the state. People had what they needed. They had houses, they had cars, they had jobs, and, you know, they were rebuilding their infrastructure. And yet in America, there were still a lot of people that had outhouses, and they suffered from the Depression for years and years. And a lot of people died during that Depression that we hardly ever hear anything about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing it today. Friedrich Berg contacted me not too long ago, and he said, I think maybe, certainly in your lifetime, he said to me, we may see individual trillionaires for the first time. That is ludicrous.
Oh, that is terrible.
How can somebody possibly have $1 trillion?
Only because they scammed it from the rest of the people.
Exactly, exactly. So, you see, this is really the basis of this occult damnation of the NSDAP. And, you know, of Germany, this Goodrich Clark book is a sweeping condemnation of Germany itself. You know, this undercurrent was everywhere, and this is really what fostered the NS movement and inspired them all. Not really. It was the economic exploitation and the inequity Inequal societies always breed chaos. We can see it increasing by the day here.
Oh, it's right.
It's starting to get bad. It's getting bad in Britain. And in my view, the Olympics just exacerbates it. You know, it's not... I mean, that's like saying that the Tea Party and kind of the conservative or... I wouldn't even call them really conservative, but, you know, it would be like saying that that is the foundation of like maybe a third party that came up and succeeded. No, it isn't. There's deeper reasons. It's the inequality of the society. It's the loss of identity of a nation. When you have, you know, myriads of all these different fifth columns, you know, groups and entities, foreigners from all over the world that have, you know, maybe loyalty to their home country still, or, you know, uncertain identity, or they're bringing the homeland with them. You got all this stuff converging in one country like the U.S. today. And this happened in Germany. This is it was a cosmic stew. You're going to have serious problems. And that is the basis of any third party, such as the NSDAP, or, you know, if the Tea Party were to get into power. I'm not saying they will, but that's the basis of those movements. It isn't Ariosophy. He's trying to say that Ariosophy is the basis of the NSDAP. No, it isn't. The only reason the NSDAP used that Aryan Jewish thing was to separate the Jews out, was to get all these fifth columnists who really didn't feel and think German out of the country, to separate them out institutionally and then ultimately push them out in whatever way that was. Now, as far as, you know, political Catholicism, we talked about the Central Reich Church. If Hitler had been able to unify the faiths and got rid of political Catholicism as preached from Rome, that fifth column would have been dealt with without eliminating the faith.
Right.
Emigration. He wanted Jews physically removed from the country.
Sounds good.
Got to stay. Right. So there, Ariosophy was not the basis of the NSDAP. And as a matter of fact, there is absolutely zero evidence, none at all. It's pure hearsay. Somebody just inventing it, that Hitler ever read the work of Guido von List or Jörg Lanz von Liebenfels. Whoops. So anybody that says those two were his inspiration, where's your proof?
Right.
And he never read Blavatsky. We don't even know if Hitler even
knew
who about
she was. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he probably heard of her.
Right.
But there's no proof he read any of that stuff. Right. None of it.
Now, we also have to consider whether the Freemasons had infiltrated the Vatican by then. Because, yeah. I mean, that's a big issue also.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And as far as that, the cosmic stew type thing, he describes it as kind of cultural pessimism. Very much so. When you lose your identity, your social fabric starts unraveling. It's not Ariosophy. It's the unraveling social fabric. It's the religion falling apart. No one's going to church anymore. You got people murdering each other. You got people on the street. You got rampant prostitution. You got incredible inequality. You got investors from every foreign country coming and buying up your country. That is the foundation of the NSDAP. It's not Ariosophy. Ariosophy was just one component where you had some supporters and some people who were grabbing onto that in the midst of this cosmic stew, who then supported the NSDAP and became part of it. It wasn't the basis of the NSDAP.
And a lot of people would like to make the Thule Society the basis, whereas you indicate it certainly wasn't. And right. The people that belonged to that society were very upstanding people in the community.
Yeah, yeah. They weren't quite like the Masons. In fact, they were opposed to Masonry.
Right.
they were not Masons. They were opposed to that. They may have been, you know, kind of secret society type, but they weren't Masons. And that's important too. They saw themselves as an antithesis to Jutesism and Masonry. And of course, there's a book by another scholar called The Catholic Roots of Nazism. So I'd like to see him and Goodrick Clark go head to head.
That would be interesting.
He was right. How about it has many roots, as any movement does, because every people has many roots.
Of course.
Yeah.
But you know, with the thing in Germany and with the issues and the culture breakdown here, it basically is all from the same person. The same people generate this in just about every country they go to, because it helps them to benefit and to be to live off that society.
Right, right. One thing I do want to point out before we close up today, the Olympics, I call it the Zy Olympics. I've been boycotting it, as my colleagues has. Because it's just so Zion infiltrated. It's awful. I don't like the all-seeing eye little mascot and all that. But comparing today's Olympics to Germany in 1936, Hitler did not have to let the black athletes compete. There's one historian. His first name's Jeremy. I can't think of his last name. It starts with an S. Shop, I think. S-C-H-A-A-P. He wrote a very good book on Owens and the truth that he wasn't snubbed.
No, he wasn't.
That Hitler actually made eye contact with him and waved to him. There's now a German journalist who asserts, and he's certainly not pro-Hitler or anything, at least from what we can tell, that there is a photograph of the two shaking hands somewhere out there. That would have been a great PR stunt for Hitler anyway. And it's not like he would not meet with the black and shake hands, because he met Dr. S.J. Wright in 1932, who was studying at Heidelberg at the time, and Hitler actually sat down and talked with him and met with him. So, you know, Hitler wasn't averse to sitting down with a black gentleman, okay? It's nonsensical. So I'm sure his reason for leaving the stadium was quite legitimate, and it would have been Cornelius Johnson, not Jesse Owens, who was quote-unquote snubbed anyway. And then, of course, you know, the Germans knew what their times were. They knew where these African Americans were already falling in the ranks just strictly from their performances before. So if they really wanted to win and cheat these African Americans out of their chance at victory, and Hitler really wanted to be a jerk, he could have said they're not allowed to compete. Anti-black racism was the prevailing order of the day back then. There were very few countries who were friendly towards Africans at that time. In fact, it still continues today. There are some countries that still are anti-African.
And look at how the United States was in 1936.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've got articles about it. We had forced labor in concentration camps, and blacks were in them. And there's pictures of them cuffed and chained to poles, and they're being punished. This was in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So, United States, you need to start studying your history more. You did have forced labor. You had concentration camps. You did.
Right. Yeah.
And you had rampant racism, and you seized Japanese people's property, just like the Germans seized some Jewish property. You know, I'm not going for this hypocritical thing anymore.
Right.
Of course, today's Olympics, the intolerance has been incredible. We got at least three athletes booted for quote-unquote racist tweets. Let's think about that comparison. In today's context of diversity, multiculturalism, acceptance of all viewpoints, liberal democracy, why is that being tolerated? Okay, we're all going to criticize fascism, like Jim Mars. Oh, fascism. Okay, how are we not acting quote unquote fascist then? How are we not imposing on free speech, free political association, and free thought when we're booting athletes for one little statement?
Right. Isn't that ridiculous?
It's insane. It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And the people that are criticizing the one gal's hair, Gabby Douglas, black women.
Amazing.
Yeah. Her host family is white, and they had been doing her hair or helping her with her hair or something like that. She's been living with them or something.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is they're saying white people can't do black people's hair right. I just, the insanity that's coming out in our Olympics is embarrassing. And there's been other things, you know, but let's compare 36 to today. And I mean, we did have those 1960s fists up in the air for the black power athletes. They weren't booted. They'd never had their medals stripped.
And people have a right to feel good about what they've accomplished.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I think this is
Hitler salute or a fascist salute on the medal stand.
Yeah.
They'd have their medal taken away or they'd be booted out. I'm sure of it.
Yep.
So hypocrisy. And that's all I've got.
Okay. Well, it's been wonderful as usual.
Indeed. And,
so we need to, we'll talk next week at the same time. Same place, Okay. Same time.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.